Bitcoin is a technology that sits at the intersection of energy and money. It is a global monetary network and a technology that could, for the first time, enable a truly planetary energy grid. It's because Bitcoin miners transform energy into money that can be sent anywhere in the world over the internet. Our guest this week thinks that this application presents a huge opportunity for the nuclear industry as nuclear power enjoys a renaissance of its own, as humanity struggles to generate the power requirements for the next generation of the internet economy. Ryan McLeod operates under the internet handle Nuclear Bitcoiner. He's a nuclear industry professional and a Bitcoiner from Canada. And he's here today to share his thoughts around how nuclear energy specifically could transform the game theory around Bitcoin mining at scale. I'm Scott Deedles. I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards, and part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how it will help them. Attaching a financial incentive or creating a mechanism to make electricity generation more efficient as a result of marrying that technology with Bitcoin mining is a complicated idea, but it's a fascinating application for the growing global adoption of Bitcoin. Our conversation with Nuclear Bitcoiner is a great introduction to how this could potentially play out. So if you're interested to learn something about the future of Bitcoin mining and energy grids, stick around. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. This week we are joined by Canadian Bitcoiner Ryan McLeod. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Scott. It's an honor to be here.
You live online by the handle Nuclear Bitcoiner, and you have this sort of very, very niche expertise. Maybe for our listeners, as we start the conversation, we just hear a little bit about your career in the nuclear space and how you got involved with Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, I'll admit the last 4 years have been a very weird experience for me since taking Bitcoin seriously. I've worked in the nuclear industry for about 10 years, but like, I'm not anything fancy like an engineer or a scientist or anything. I'm a lab tech that supports a lot of the science and research that goes on in our nuclear industry. Basically, my specific job is I support corrosion analysis in the CANDU nuclear power plants in Canada. And yeah, when I started to learn about Bitcoin, like, it very quickly became apparent that its relationship to energy was going to be incredibly valuable to the nuclear power industry, because they generate a lot of power and sometimes the grid doesn't always need all of that power. So that having a customer that can consume that power and make it bring value to it when it wouldn't otherwise be useful is an incredibly valuable tool for grids and generators. So I just kind of got interested in this idea at the intersection of nuclear power and Bitcoin mining. And it seemed almost fate-like, at the right place at the right time. Like, I had been introduced to Bitcoin mining, or just Bitcoin in general. Like, everyone has a story of, 2010, 2011, like the end of end stuff, paying attention to like Ron Paul's presidency, attempts, and there was like the Zeitgeist documentaries, and that kind of got me interested in like fractional reserve banking and how like all of these systems work. But then I never really took the plunge into Bitcoin. It was just a fad that passed by, and I got more attentive to my family and career and just all the other stuff that can distract your attention. And then it was 2021 when it was, in fact, my wife that dropped this idea when we were having a conversation around the time that Elon Musk was criticizing Bitcoin mining's energy footprint for using too much hydrocarbons. And she just unironically just threw out the idea, just like, well, maybe we should be looking at mining Bitcoin with nuclear power. That would definitely remediate that image problem. And she just assumed that was just a given. She just wasn't as deep down the rabbit hole as myself at the time. And she was just like, yeah, if it just needs electricity, like we generate a ton of electricity with nuclear power, so why not put those two together? And it just captured my attention in an immense way, is so that I've been submitting this idea of using it as a complementary load for small modular reactors when they finally mature, because they will need a customer that can ensure that they get 100% utility, especially if they're in microgrid or small grid scenarios. And it just kind of started to take on a life of its own, where I'm started getting invited on podcasts, and it started with Ben Sessions on Wired White Bullish. And then before I knew it, Peter McCormick invited me and flew me to Bedford to come and speak about this topic because I had just kind of poked him about hosting Alex Epstein, an advocate for oil and gas and hydrocarbons in general. And then he hosted another guy that was countering Alex's perspective. And then I was just like, nobody talked about nuclear at all in either of these discussions. And he was like, all right, then you come Bedford and talk about this. And I was like, why me? Like, there's plenty of other nuclear experts that could do it justice in so many better ways. And I was still at that point because I had not really gone deep into the nuclear rabbit hole. I was just, it was a job. Like I worked in the nuclear industry and I did my job as a lab tech. I had never gone into the broader landscape of like nuclear reactors are being built around the world. We're advancing small modular reactors. There's reactors being shut down across the United States. And there's a lot going on when you finally get immersed into it, much like Bitcoin. If you're not paying attention, you don't see any of this stuff. And you just kind of get a tangential perspective to it. And then I started immersing myself into it and seeing that there was now nobody in the Bitcoin space really serving the nuclear angle. Like they were all seeing that perspective that nuclear power is on its downswing, that it's not getting the political support that it needs, it doesn't have the social support that it needs to sustain it. And then around the end of 22 was when it seems that narrative really started to flip. There was events happening in the world where people were really considering energy security and nuclear power started to come back around again. And I know I've been meandering around a little bit, but it's just been a meandering path for me just through this, learning about nuclear power, learning about Bitcoin mining, putting these two together and just finding the right way to articulate this idea for both audiences, because they're two wildly different audiences. Like the Bitcoin miners, they understand power. The Bitcoiners, they want, when I talk to them about nuclear power, they're just like, when can we get our hands on a small reactor and we can just build in the middle of nowhere and just generate hash rate with it and it can support a community? And then the nuclear power, they're on the completely opposite spectrum. And they're just like, we have enough to deal with. We don't need to put Bitcoin into our basket of things that people are criticizing us for. And we just want to build our reactors and generate power and help the grids, help humanity, help just empower as many people as possible. But it's a tough cross-section of industries to support because they're both very poorly understood by the general populace. And I found myself in this niche. And now I'm the guy talking about mining Bitcoin with nuclear power.
Yeah, I never really thought about it that way. Of course, they both in their own ways face troubling stigmas that are just not really factual or based in reality. Huh. We did an episode with Daz Bay back in the spring talking about flexible demand load and some of the, just with regular or traditional, more traditional energy sources for stabilizing energy grids, but it might be worth just starting with a little bit of a primer on how nuclear power is different and why it might be appealing for as a power source for mining Bitcoin.
Yeah, that is a good question because like nuclear power, for the one thing that the thing that it has going the best for is it's the most dense form of power generation that we have. Like the amount of power that you can generate per unit of space, per unit of materials for construction and the fuel that is required, the amount of power that can be generated with nuclear is just immense, off the charts, like nothing even compares to it. And then when you start thinking about if the goal is to generate hash rate, then nuclear power is going to be incredibly attractive. But then there's a lot of regulatory and licensing all of the historical and legacy burden that comes with nuclear power and just people's understanding of radiation and their experience with the accidents that have happened in the decades past. And it's just been an interesting way of just to observe how it's evolving now. Like we went through a bear market for the last 10 years after Fukushima happened, and now nuclear power is back in vogue. We're seeing data centers start to acquire rights to nuclear power plants. The recent announcement that, was it Google or Microsoft? Yeah, it was Microsoft that was the one that was doing the Three Mile Island deal. They're reviving a nuclear power plant that was retired several years ago. Like there's social and industrial interest in generating the kind of power that only nuclear can really provide. Like, if I don't have an, like, I don't take issue with hydrocarbons. Like, they're very reliable. They can be transported to where they need to be. They're great. But if the goal is to reduce our reliance on them, to reduce the carbon footprint, really nuclear power is the only one that can displace them in any meaningful way. Wind and solar are great, but they need to be backed up with reliable capacity, such as batteries or natural gas. So there's always going to be challenges with them. And there's also a lot of constraints when you try to build windmills and solar panels, like further and further from where the load is required. And that requires a lot of infrastructure to deliver that power to the grids. Whereas, like, at least with nuclear power, it's dense. It's in one location. You just need one power line to deliver it into a large community. But then on the flip side, that becomes another flaw, because we're looking at alternative markets than nuclear power can be applied to, like smaller markets. Like, we want to deploy micro reactors to small grids in northern Canadian communities, which that can be challenging, because if you deploy more power than the community needs, you're going to leave much of that power unused for a good chunk of the year. And it's necessary, because when you build a grid, you have to ensure that there's going to be excess capacity to meet whatever the peak load is going to be, and then also a buffer on top of that. And typically, we do that with, we'll have a baseload generator, like a coal plant, hydroelectric dam, a nuclear power plant. They'll supply the baseload that supports just the always on needs. And then we will use typically a hydrocarbon plant to, as a peaking plant, to manage the flexibility when the demand increases beyond what the baseload needs are. That's been the standard approach for decades. And now that we're trying to transition away from hydrocarbons, we're trying to come up with more complicated ways to serve that role. And yeah, it's just resulting in proposals for windmills, solar panels, batteries, hydrogen generation, desalination, synthetic fuels, like a combination of all of these different things that can consume load and generate load at different times of day and kind of arbitrage the supply and demand of when and where it's needed. And it can get quite complicated. And I honestly think it would be so much simpler if we just overbuild our baseload generation with nuclear power, fill in that margin between supply and demand with Bitcoin miners, and just they can offer that buffer that they can then be the ones to play the role as the peaker plant, that then they can curtail their load. And we can serve the communities much better with a flexible load. And we also are going to be supporting it with one of the cleanest and safest energy generation sources that we have available to us. So, like, that's a huge aspect of where, like, Bitcoin mining and nuclear power play a role together. They complement each other very well, just with their energy density generation and consumption. And then, because nuclear power is not very flexible, the Bitcoin miners can offer that flexibility on top of it. And then they also complement other, like, large static loads that would go with nuclear power, as we're seeing with a lot of data centers. Like, I see a very promising future where the large static data centers that need the always on, like, high redundancy tier, like tier 3, tier 4 type data centers, being complemented by, like, a tier 0, tier 1 Bitcoin mining data center that can operate flexibly on the margins and complement whatever the local grid needs for them. So I see a very positive relationship for these two technologies going forward.
Yeah, it's a synergy. And so, just so I have this right, basically, nuclear plants can't easily scale up and down in terms of their power output, but the Bitcoin miners, they can. You can turn them on and off or partial. You know, you have a lot more control with the energy consumption of Bitcoin miners. This is something they're doing, maybe not with nuclear, but this is something they're doing on a pretty significant scale in Texas with the Texas Energy Grid, right, where they're really a partner, so that the Bitcoin miners can consume energy that would be otherwise wasted. And often they're being paid to do it, so that they're making Bitcoin and they're being paid by the power suppliers. And then when the electricity demand goes up, the miners turn off.
It's so cool, because you can see it on the ERCOT charts. Like, they have graphs that show the demand response. Just the price of power goes up, the Bitcoin mining load goes down. the price of power comes back down, the Bitcoin mining load comes right back up. It's beautiful to watch, and it's so simple once you get it. But trying to explain this to people that do not see what we see, it is incredibly taxing and challenging. And then, like, on top of that, there's like, yeah, flexibility is just one thing, and then like their location agnosticism is another huge benefit. Like seeing what they're doing with use cases like gridless, they'll go to a underused hydroelectric dam in the middle of nowhere in Malawi that was getting 50% usage out of its power generation. And now they drop a trailer on that site. They're getting 100% usage. The local utility is earning more revenue. So now they're more profitable. They can offer lower rates to the locals. And then they can also start expanding that infrastructure out to more homes. And then because the Bitcoin miners are just computers, you can peel off 1, 2, 3 computers as you connect more homes to this new grid. And it's very complementary. And you can do that at so many different scales, whether it's a few kilowatts to a few megawatts to even like gigawatts if we start getting crazy. And then on top of that, there's the heat. Like I just saw another instance. I think it was SAS Mining is working with a project in Norway where they're doing district heating with Bitcoin miners as the primary heat source. And there's examples of Marathon doing that. And there's every day there's another one. There's a spa in New York. There's a greenhouse that grows tulips. Like there's so many different examples of the versatile applications that Bitcoin miners can apply to because they're basically just electric space heaters. They're a little more expensive than your standard off the shelf space heater, but that space heater doesn't pay you back in Bitcoin. It's going to change our relationship with our heating appliances in a very unique way as this starts to go forward and it starts finding itself in more of these niches. Like it's going to be crazy when just like your regular space heater is just a hashboard. And they're coming up with ways to make it more visually appealing and wife approved, which is a essential component of some of these tech toys.
Yeah. If you need heat or you want to do something where the byproduct is heat and you have the optional, you know, the opportunity to make Bitcoin, there really isn't a reason to not do it. And we were talking about this with Christian Ander, who's in Sweden a couple of weeks ago on the show. Yeah, basically a lot of those homes in Scandinavia, because of the way they're heated too, it's not like in Canada with central gas. So it actually also fits in a lot more naturally to the infrastructure of how they build their homes. Yeah, we did an episode in the spring as well with Yoni Appleberg talking about the idea that Bitcoin is Kardashev scale technology. And I see this the synergy between nuclear power and Bitcoin really being sort of the proto phase of, you know, a planetary monetary network enabled by a planetary energy grid. Like this idea that we can have, as you mentioned, because the computers are location agnostic, it means that you can monetize power anywhere in the world and you can kind of meet demand anywhere the power is being produced. And I think about this with like all of the oil rigs in the middle of nowhere in northern Alberta where they can instead of just flaring the gas off, they can attach a generator to it, create electricity, turn the miners on there. Same idea, right? So the gas would need to be flared anyways. You might as well make Bitcoin with it and produce some kind of a positive outcome. But if you extend that thinking out, and I can tell this is where you're at, is like, imagine the global ability to monetize energy anywhere. And then that gives you the opportunity to start thinking about how much can be done, like how much more production can be brought online because there's now a financial incentive to do that and to provide power to the two isolated communities.
I know. It's funny. Just like the Bitcoin miners are just like, where's the waste? Give me the waste. We will turn your waste into money. We don't care if you're just flaring gas, if it's just methane leaking from a landfill, or if it's cow shit at this point. Like the fact that we're hearing examples of Bitcoin miners monetizing agriculture waste products, that changes the dynamic for these farmers. Like I've actually have my wife's father uncle. My wife's uncle has a dairy farm, and he is looking at costing a biodigester for that farm, and he expects that he can generate about 700, 800 kilowatt hours pretty consistently. So, like you can should get a pretty decent amount of hash rate out of that. Small scale. And then on top of that, as we were talking about the heat, you can recycle that heat into the digestion process and make it even more efficient. And he's just one of dozens, if not hundreds, of dairy farmers in the general area. Like, it's just outside of Ottawa. Like, there's a lot of farms in this area, and there's a lot of opportunity to capture value out of that refuse. And like, then there's also like sewers. Like, I was hanging out when I was in Ghana for the African Bitcoin conference. I was hanging out with a bunch of South Africans, and it was like after the conference, and they showed me this video of a street in Johannesburg exploding, and like a bus got lifted almost like 6 meters in the air because the methane buildup in the sewer just, it ignited and it just blew out this entire street. And then we just started thinking, there's like there's Bitcoin in the sewers too. Like, we can mine Bitcoin with that too. Like, that's if you can make methane with it, if you can combust it, we can make Bitcoin with it. So there's so many different pathways to create this. And then now we have so much other stuff layered on top of it. Like, we have entities that wield billions, trillions of dollars that are accumulating Bitcoin, and they're going to need access to this blockchain. So they're going to need to start thinking about securing access to hash rate themselves. And then that plays into this, the other angle that just the other day we saw that there was an announcement that the BRICS nations are going to start helping each other build hash rate within their respective nations to circumvent the SWIFT network and not have to deal with the Western nations. They can conduct trade in their own way without having to rely on rails that are potentially adversarial to them, which is a huge change to the way things have been in recent decades, because we've lived the last 50 or so years in the petrodollar systems. Like, if you trade oil, you trade it in US dollars. That system is dead now, and there are dozens of nations now making moves to completely replace that system with something different where they don't have to be dependent upon another nation's currency. So it's going to kick off this game theory about, like, you need to secure hash rate if you want to conduct trade on this network. Then you're going to have to pay attention to the sources of generation that supply that hash rate and, like, cultivate them and build out more. Like, there's going to be a lot of low hanging fruit, like, as we're seeing in places like Peru, Ethiopia, where they already have massive amounts of hydropower that was being underused. But sooner or later, that capacity is going to be brought up to full utility. And then they're going to start looking around for, like, how do we generate as much power as we can, as quickly as we can? And, like, although recent examples of building nuclear power, like, yes, it takes a long time to build, but, like, once you've got that momentum and you're have sequentially, like, sequenced construction projects, kind of like what China's doing. Like, they start 3 or 4 new nuclear power plants a year, and they finish 3 or 4 power plants a year. And, like, they've got, like, this 5-6 year time cycle that they're going where they're just like, yeah, we start them today, they're done in 6 years, and we've got 20 under construction at any given time. Like, we need to start thinking about doing something similar in the Western nations. But then you see the examples of Vogel or Hinkley, or the one they just built in Finland, and the one, like, the ones that the French are building. Like, they're slow, they cost a lot of money. Like, there's so much bureaucracy involved with these things. It seems like the West has lost our touch at building these mega projects like we used to be able to. Like the reactors that America built, like, most of them were built pre-70s. And then part of my mind goes to just, like, well, something happened in the 70s that made it much more challenging to finance nuclear power projects. It totally shifted the time preference. And if you need a long time preference to build nuclear power plants, the way that fiat money affects your time preference, it does not align well with building nuclear power. And it shifts your time preference to, like, quick returns, and where, especially when the government is throwing out money left, right, and center for just, like, well, just build some windmills, you'll collect some tax credits, and then for 10 years, like, even if the grid doesn't need that power, we'll still pay anyways. And it creates all these malincentives where there's too much of inefficient power being put on the grids and not enough good, efficient power put on the grids, just because of the bad incentives just all around because of the money that we use.
Yeah, yeah. For anyone who didn't pick up on that reference, what did happen in 1970, or it was in 1971, was Richard Nixon ending the gold standard, the redemption of U.S. dollars for gold, and which was meant to be temporary. And there's nothing more temporary than a government Nothing more permanent than a temporary government measure. I think you're the first person, this is to come way back to the start of the conversation, I think you're the first person on the show that's mentioned Zeitgeist. And I also remember watching Zeitgeist in probably 2008 or 2009. And that was the first time I had heard about fractional reserve banking. Obviously, I am a little bit slower, and so I didn't click immediately for Bitcoin. It took me another 10 years. But yeah, that is so funny. Zeitgeist was really, I think, for the first time, a lot of people had an introduction to the idea of fiat money and currency debasement as a sort of a tool. You know, to come back to what you were saying about the BRICS, I think that this, the other thing that is, you know, these multiple sort of waterfall of incentives, because if these countries now also, they benefit dually from creating financial sovereignty by creating hash power in the form of Bitcoin mining that exists within their own country, and they at the same time are upgrading their, you know, their power grids or becoming more financially sovereign or even managing their own waste better. Like, there is just so many reasons to think that this is going to be something that is adopted elsewhere around the world. And then, to your point about in North America, we're both in Canada, and it feels like we can't get anything built anymore. Yeah, a tale of two directions.
Well, on the upside, like, at least our refurbishments are going very well in Ontario. We're completely gutting and rebuilding the major components of the Bruce reactors and the Darlington reactors, and potentially half of the Pickering reactors. So that, and that's been going very well. It's been on time, on budget. So proving that Ontario still has what it takes to be able to do this, but a new build is not something that Canada has done in a long time. And so that's what they're hoping for at the Bruce site, to build out a new set of reactors up there. And then on top of that, like, Canada's very much engaged with small reactors. So we're trying to get at 6 to 10 of these SMRs, the small modular reactor types, ready for market in at various sizes. We've got like micro reactors in like the 1 to 10 megawatt range. We're looking at different coolant types using molten salt or high temperature gas rather than the typical like light water reactors that we're used to. Well, Canada in fact is heavy water reactors. That's the unique feature of ours, is we use water that is deuterium instead of just typical hydrogen because of the way that it reacts with neutrons, and it allows us to use uranium that does not need to be enriched. So we just need to refine it, purify it, and put it in the fuel form, but it doesn't need to be enriched in the concentration of the uranium-235 isotope to the uranium-238 isotope, because it naturally occurs at a 0.8% ratio, but then like the American reactors, they need to enrich that to a 3% ratio. A lot of the new reactors that are coming out, they're looking at roughly like 20% enrichment. And then if you're talking about like the submarine fuel and weapon grade, you're getting up into the 80, 90% enrichment. And then just while that's on my mind, one of the crazy ideas that I've been having on my mind is that if the incentive to generate hash rate does exceed what we expect, and they are building power and nuclear power in particular in order to generate more hash rate, it could conceivably reach a point where we are looking for sources of fuel for those reactors beyond just what we can acquire from geological repositories. Like, Canada has very good uranium deposits. There's lots of good uranium deposits throughout Africa. Kazakhstan, Australia has lots of good uranium deposits, but sooner or later, a lot of that's going to be exhausted and we're going to have to look for alternatives. And there's a lot of fuel for reactors potentially in the nuclear weapons stockpiles. So it wouldn't be unfeasible that if the incentive is strong enough to generate power to fight this so-called hash war that Max Keiser and Jason Lowry like to promote in the cyberspace, then it would not be infeasible that they would pull this fuel from meat space in order to sustain their hash rate capacity for cyberspace. So it's a little bit far-fetched in like decades down the road from now, but like, who knows? Like, if there is, like, we Bitcoiners, like, we see the effects of incentives on everything, on everywhere. And it's just, a bad incentive shift in one way, it might not have an immediate effect, but like, yeah, you compound 2% in shitification of society for 50 years. Yeah, eventually you're swimming in a fishbowl of shit and you don't know what it looks like outside of that fishbowl until you can go into the Bitcoin fishbowl and you're just like, oh, there is actually a way to swim in pristine water and not have to live in this crappy environment that's just gotten crappier by 2% every year. If we can shift the incentive to be 2% better every year, we can make our fishbowl cleaner in all in due time, but it also creates like just the incentive to be better and to do better. And then yeah, if that starts catching hold, like, yeah, who knows? Maybe we're just like, why are we fighting? Like, we've got all this fuel and these nuclear weapons. Like, we need more power so that we can play this Bitcoin game more. Like, it needs a little bit more refining, but it's like, it's when you see what we see, like, it's not as far-fetched as it might be telling this crazy idea to a normie.
Yeah, I mean, I have said for a long time, I think Bitcoin is the most peaceful technology that's ever been created because, you know, as a more straight line argument, in a finite money world, the cost of kinetic warfare becomes just totally nonsensical and, you know, it's cost prohibitive when you're building things that are designed to be used once, like stuff that blows stuff up is really expensive and it doesn't last very long, and the cost of, you know, the armaments required to project physical force is just so vast. But to extend that one step further, if it would make more sense financially to use weapons grade uranium to mine Bitcoin, then that would be a really very cool secondary effect of a great way to end mutually assured destruction. That's a very cool idea.
Well, yeah, wouldn't it be crazy if, like, yeah, instead of Ukraine and Russia engaged in kinetic warfare, they were engaged in cyber warfare through hash rate. Like, they both have pretty substantial energy generation capacity, and like, they would just be fighting over who gets to issue transactions on the ledger. And like, and that's the play. It's like, there's going to be entities that are just like, well, if they're increasing their hash rate and they're influence on creating blocks and what goes into those blocks, then that means that our share of an influence is going down. So how do we counter that except for increasing our share by increasing our investment in our power infrastructure that supports our hash rate infrastructure? It's a very potentially positive flywheel that this game theory is going to kick off between all of these entities that are now seeing the value of what we see now. Like, for God's sakes, we have Larry Fink on our team. Like, that is, like, I've only been around for 4 years in this space, and like, the amount of advancement from, like, when I got in, we were still barely 100 exahash, and then that was around the time that China kicked out all the miners, and now we're pushing 700 exahash. Like, that is an incredible growth in this market. I endured the bear market. I rode it all the way from the top back to the bottom and back up to the top again, and I have not wavered in my conviction like one little bit. And once other people start to see this, especially people that have just obscene amounts of money and wealth, and they need to have secured access to use this ledger to exchange and trade in that wealth, or even just secure it as their store of value, they are going to want to ensure that they have the ability to transact it when they need it. And if the hash rate is all in an adversarial nation, that becomes very questionable. So there's going to be incentive to make sure that there is hash rate in friendly nations. And it's game theory at every level. Like, when one increases, we have to increase in kind in order to match it. So, like, yeah, BRICS are doing their thing. Like, is NATO going to match in kind? Now that Trump's in office, like, who knows? Because he's definitely express some positive overtures towards Bitcoin and making sure that all the hash rate is made in America. And like, I love his sentiment, but it doesn't quite work like that. But that's the kind of thinking that kicks off these ideas that like Kaiser and Lowry are promoting. It's just going to create a flywheel.
Yeah, of good outcomes. Another idea that Max Kaiser talks a lot about that I'm interested in and is related to this is that Bitcoin could be the only energy usage that might feasibly offset the sort of infinite energy consumption capacity of AI. And because this is also intimately related to nuclear, right? As the reason why these private companies like Google and Amazon and Microsoft are interested in nuclear is because of the energy demands of these large language models and where they see the consumption going in the future.
That's another fascinating one, because they're already starting to run up against roadblocks. So if anybody's been paying attention to Talon Energy and the TeraWulf story, they started building a small Bitcoin mining data center behind the meter at the Susquehanna nuclear power plant in Pennsylvania. And they were concurrently building a larger data center that eventually, I think it was earlier this year, that Amazon acquired for, like, I think they're going to, they want a total of 900 megawatts. It was almost like $1 billion deal or something like that. But now what they're showing is up to a certain point, that's okay. But when you start pulling large volumes of power off of the grid and they're no longer contributing to the grid costs and just their ongoing maintenance and operations, then that's going to have a second order effect of now the local ratepayers are going to have to cover those costs. And so now there is an interesting dynamic going on where the, I guess FERC, the Federal Electricity Regulation Company, not sure exactly what the full acronym is, but they are currently in litigation against the PGM grid that it hosts the Susquehanna power plant about who is going to cover these grid costs if they're pulling nearly a gigawatt of power behind the meter. And that was the intention of acquiring a data center behind the meter in the first place, is so that they would not have to deal with any of the grid interconnection like expenses that would normally go with building an industrial operation. But now that's starting to put some tension in these acquisitions. At least with Three Mile Island, the power plant was shut down, so bringing it back online, it's not going to change anything with the local grid. But Susquehanna offers almost 2 gigawatts of power to that local community. And if half of it goes offline to support a data center by the meter, then yeah, that's going to have impacts on the cost of electricity for the locals. So there's ongoing litigation in the situation right now, which is one of the reasons why I suspect that the big data centers are taking such a large interest in small modular reactors and smaller reactors that they can build as microgrid campuses that are completely isolated from grids. And they will be able to set up their operations and not have to deal with any of this, because they can set up 10 megawatts in some locality or 300 megawatts. They can be a little bit more precise in what they need and not have to deal with that grid cost. But then on the flip side, what we're seeing with Bitcoin miners doing is seeing they want to engage with the grid. They're saying, like, we have the capabilities that we can play these power markets like pros. Like, we can say, like, your power cost goes up. Okay. We turn off our load. Okay. Your power load goes down. We can turn up our load to balance that. And they're seeing that as an arbitrage opportunity, where they're just like, well, we already paid for a block of power. So now we can either sell that back to the grid when it's more advantageous to sell it at whatever the local spot price is, compared to what Bitcoin mining offers. Because that's one of the beautiful things about Bitcoin, is if you know the global hash rate and you know the cost of Bitcoin at the time in US dollars, you know exactly where your break even is. So you can say, like, at 9 cents a kilowatt hour, that's when we turn off this tier of our hash rate. At 12 cents kilowatt hour, we turn off this tier of our hash rate, and we instead get compensated by the grid ancillary programs. Like, we're seeing that all over Texas. Like, Ohio has different similar programs like that. Georgia has similar programs like that. That's kind of why you see the Bitcoin miners are attracted to these markets that have these programs, where they are not just a good, large, flexible customer, but they're also able to service the grid in a way that is a lot more affordable than paying a natural gas plant to sit idle for 90% of the year, turn on for that 10% when it's really needed, but it's just an idle cost that's not being utilized. Whereas the Bitcoin miners, they're generating a useful product for the market that the market wants, because it has a market price, and then they turn off when it's not affordable, to be creating that product. They perform the exact same role as a Peter plant, but it's way better. And that's why we're starting to see things like there's like the owners of these Peter plants engaging in litigation and policy fights to limit the ability of Bitcoin miners to participate in these markets because they participate too good and they're cutting in on their market share. It's hilarious to watch. And it's just like they're making the system more efficient, but we're the people that are benefiting from essentially like rent seeking on these markets are pissed about it. And good.
Yeah, it's wild. It just makes me think, like, imagine if you could go retroactively and put a gold deposit next to every power plant in the world and they could just choose to do the digging and do some of the gold mining at the time, you know, when everyone was sleeping. It's like, this is a total no-brainer, but we're sort of like smushing people who have enjoyed a monopoly, a very profitable monopoly for a long time. And this technology is just also so disruptive. It just makes me think about like how Bitcoin's game theory really does force, like, you know, it's like Saifedean says, you can ignore Bitcoin, but you can't ignore like the cost or the result of ignoring Bitcoin.
Yeah, like, man, my trip to El Salvador just got 15% cheaper in the last 24 hours. Like, that was wild. I didn't expect that, but it is cool to wake up at 2 a.m. in the morning and say, like, oh, Trump won. Oh, Bitcoin's at 104,000 Canadian. That's cool. No, that's great because I got a trip go to El Salvador coming up. And yeah, I'm going to be spending some Bitcoin. So it's nice to know that my Bitcoin's going to go a little further than it would have just a few days ago. And like, God, I'm glad this nonsense is over because, man, it's just been a slog getting through all that.
Yeah. And just in general, on like broader time horizon, having things get cheaper over time instead of more expensive is probably the greatest single life hack that exists for anyone. Like the fact that it's available for anyone is also another aspect of the game theory that we're sort of just getting started on.
Well, and it changes your behavior. Like I even started to notice myself, like just acting in that fiat way where it was just like, well, I know things are going to be more expensive. So just like, yeah, take on debt, spend money now, just buy shit. We'll worry about it later. And then you start getting into Bitcoin and you're just like, you start being a little bit more discerning about what you're spending your money on. Because you're just like, well, if I don't buy that today, maybe I could buy two of them in a few months. And it changes your perspective. But then I just started getting the mindset of just like, I just want to keep stacking Bitcoin because I have a family and they're going to need it in the future. They're going to have all kinds of, they're going to have their experiences and tribulations, and they're going to need an anchor that kind of helps support them. So like, I've got my kids, like they collect their allowance. They've been making bets against each other in it. And so they're very much into this lifestyle, but they just see me kind of doing it in my crazy way. And they're just like, oh, dad's doing his crazy thing. But then they see number go up and it's like, yeah, maybe dad's not that crazy. And then they go and talk with their friends. They're just like, oh, that's just a scam. You should just sell all of it. It is funny raising kids in these days, and like, I'm hoping to have a good time when they get to go and experience the Bitcoin culture of El Salvador, and they actually get to see what it's like to be able to spend one's Bitcoin in the real world. Because yeah, for now they've just been hodlers, but it's been an interesting experience. And then as far as like, yeah, holding Bitcoin.
That's very interested to hear. I have friends who are Bitcoiner friends that are also raising kids and raising them orange pill from the start, and so it's very cool. I often wonder, you know, it's the same as young people now who are the first people that have grown up, say, with social media their whole lives, and how they interact with it differently than people at my age or older. And Bitcoin will be the same. There will be, in 20 years, people that don't really think of Bitcoin as being weird at all. They'll just think of it as money. And those people will think it was hilarious that we used to use pieces of paper with the faces of kings on them. And that was how we decided what things were worth and how to exchange and trade value. And it had nothing to do with energy or anything to do with a production cost tied to the reality.
Well, doesn't it already feel antiquated when you try and do stuff in the fiat system? Like, Like when I have meetings with my bankers and they're just like, oh yeah, we're going to have to ask permission to do this, to move your locked in retirement account in order to this place in order for you to actually like invest it in the things you want. And I'm just like, I just want to buy Bitcoin with it. I don't really care about all that stuff. And it's just going through all of this process just to get access to my money is a nightmare. And then you experience Bitcoin. You're just like, yeah, so I just sign the transaction and it goes where I want to go anywhere in the world, anytime in the world. And I can sign a transaction from anywhere in the world. Like I don't have to be in my local jurisdiction at my local bank branch to sign a transaction. It is so futuristic once you get accustomed to it. But then it's like living in two different worlds and we can just flip flop between the fiat and the Bitcoin brain. And it's fun to see just how different they are, but it's like, it's so antiquated dealing with this old system.
Yeah, one of my favorite analogies is another one from Safe Dean I just heard the other day, and he was comparing it to the change that Bitcoin is ushering into money and banking being the same as when you used to make a phone call and the operator had to connect you to the person you were calling. And there was sort of this person in the middle that would make the connection happen. And this is actually really what goes on with banks or financial institutions, payment providers in the middle. And what Bitcoin is doing is the same as removing the operator so that the phone call just goes from phone to phone. And once you could make a phone call without having the operator in the middle, it would have seemed insane to need an operator. And it will be the same for money. It will be the same for making a payment or a transaction. It's just, we just are living through it right now. And it's wild. Ryan, this has been a ton of fun. Maybe this is a good break point. I appreciate you coming on. And this topic of nuclear, I'm really interested to see how it plays out. You're on Twitter, and we'll share the link. If there's somewhere else, are you putting content out anywhere else? Listeners might be able to find more of you, or
not really. I've got a LinkedIn profile. I've got a Nosta profile, but yeah, mostly I'm a ex junkie. Just reply guy, just poking at that stuff. The nuclear people just be like, you need to take this Bitcoin thing seriously. And just I find myself in new territory that I never would have expected before. And yeah, I've got some interesting ideas I don't want to expose too early, but I'll be presenting on my talk in Bitcoin related to just like different ways that nuclear power can take advantage of Bitcoin beyond just mining. Like there's a lot of capital tied up for long periods of time that's not idle or not doing anything that I think Bitcoin can play a great use to, especially when it comes to like long-term waste management applications. And like just as we're seeing more pensions and more like institutional investors start taking this seriously, it's making that conversation a little easier. Like typically my starting point was just like, yes, Bitcoin mining is a great customer, but now I can start using the angle of just like, well, you can use it as a reserve. Well, for all of these large capital pools that you're sitting on for potentially decades. And I think it's going to be a bright future for these two technologies as they start weaving together more and more. And that's, I'm all for it. I'm on this adventure. I'm going to El Salvador. Apparently, I just got an abstract accepted at another conference in like 2 weeks after El Salvador. So it's nonstop. I have no idea where I'm going to be next. Like I had never left Ontario barely before Peter McCormick invited me to go to Bedford. And then it's been Japan, El Salvador. I was in Ghana last year. Like that's not me, but apparently it is now. So I'm just along for the ride. Thanks for having me. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, likewise. And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the show, I want to thank you as well for tuning in, and I hope to see you again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. BlockRewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits, supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and VMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.